All right, good evening, good day, Yom Tov to everyone. I thank you all for joining, those who are here, those on Zoom. Tonight, we continue the history of Zionism, part 7, entitled The British Are Coming, and we're sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas, Yona Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Tenishmoso, Tzur B'Tzorah Chaim. The Zionist movement stalled in the early years of the 20th century. The peripatetic Herzl sought the counsel of every world leader who would meet with him. The Kaiser, the Pope, the Sultan, a variety of kings and ministers who showed the faintest interest in Zionism, Herzl would meet them. Herzl even proposed to the Sultan the formation of what he called the Jewish Ottoman Land Company. But all his efforts did not produce any tangible results, even though he attracted theoretical support. For example, Kaiser Wilhelm told Herzl, "I am all in favor of the Kikes going to Palestine. The sooner they take off, the better," end quote. But he was not willing to help in any meaningful way, and Herzl became disheartened. At the same time, the long simmering dispute between the practical Zionists who wanted to focus on settlement, building the land of Israel and saving Jews from persecution, and the political Zionists who wanted to focus on statehood or at least an officially recognized homeland of some sort, that dispute came to the surface. As we saw last time, anti-Zionists of all stripes and ideologies either lost confidence in Herzl and his project or never had any confidence. And that became an issue. The dispute became even more pronounced when the Uganda project was suggested, and this becomes the beginning of the British involvement in the Zionist endeavor that will last half a century, remains controversial until today, and precipitated animosity, harsh decrees, mutual recriminations, occasional sympathy, but mostly was extremely damaging to the Jewish people. The British might have meant well at the beginning. By the 1920s, certainly by the 1930s, they no longer meant well, and we paid a very heavy price for it. It was Herzl who, after despairing of receiving a charter from the Sultan, reached out to Joseph Chamberlain, who was the British colonial secretary, happened to be the father of the infamous appeaser Neville Chamberlain, whom we will yet meet. Reached out to Chamberlain for ideas. Britain then still ruled over at least a quarter of the globe, and Herzl thought that a sliver of that empire might be allocated for Jewish settlement. And Chamberlain was sympathetic. Britain had recently seen an influx of Russian Jewish immigrants, and they had an interest, therefore, in finding another place for refugees. There was even a Royal Commission on Alien Immigration that was formed in 1902, on which Lord Nathaniel Mayer Rothschild sat. Herzl testified before that commission and stated that the solution to the refugee problem, at least its Russian-Jewish aspect, was recognition of the Jews as a people and finding for them a legally recognized home. The Rothschilds then were not at all supportive and opposed Zionism, fearing that Herzl would facilitate the dual loyalty charge that Jews could not be full British citizens and exacerbate the plight of the refugees. So how did Herzl come to Britain? It was through the auspices of one of the lesser known early Zionists, someone characterized by the historian Ben-Zion Netanyahu, the Prime Minister's father, of course, as one of the three founders of political Zionism. And that's a Brit named Israel Zangwill, who was a very well-known and popularly read author and playwright, born in London in 1864. It was Max Nordau who made the introduction, and it was Zangwill who, already in the late 1890s, early 1900s, made the rounds of British elite society. Chamberlain, Lloyd George, and even Balfour, who credited Zangwill with turning him into a Zionist. It was Zangwill's best known to us as the author of a play that ran in America beginning in 1906, entitled The Melting Pot. That's a term that he coined. Among the attendees at the Washington performance was one President Theodore Roosevelt, who was very moved by the play. It was an account of a Jew who fled after the Kishinev pogrom and moved to America. Roosevelt had already issued the first American statement supporting the aims of Zionism. That was at Zangwill's request. So Zangwill made the introduction between Herzl and all these British politicians. Herzl's testimony led to his meeting with Chamberlain. Herzl suggested Cyprus and then El Arish in the Sinai as the Jewish national home, both of which were rejected by the British because of anticipated opposition from the Greeks and the Muslims and the Egyptians. Herzl was not keen on Egypt when it was suggested. He said to Chamberlain, "We have been there," although he did visit Egypt to check it out. Chamberlain then suggested the territory of Uganda, south of Ethiopia. Today it's actually Kenya and not Uganda. That would serve the purpose, he wrote, even if Herzl desires Israel because, as Chamberlain said, he's sentimental. The Uganda plan drew support from the foreign secretary, as well as a young politician named David Lloyd George. Herzl reluctantly accepted the idea. Max Nordau called it a Nachthäusel, an asylum for the night, a way to save East European and especially Russian Jews from the horrible life they were living. It was to be a temporary refuge, and on that basis, Herzl presented it to the 6th Zionist Congress, this one also in Basel, on August 23, 1903. Note the presentation involved authorizing a feasibility study, not committing to it. Some were excited. One delegate even said Shechianu because he was overtaken by this first official recognition of the Jews as a nation and by a major power, Britain. Zangwill supported it as well. But pandemonium erupted. Many considered it a betrayal of Zionism. Others saw it as a temporary refuge, with Israel remaining the final objective. Ironically, the Russian Zionists, they were the ones who suffered the most under the Tsar, they were the most vehemently opposed to the Uganda plan. Tempers flared. Mizrahi supported the plan, and Herzl pushed it through, owing mostly to his prestige. The vote to approve sending a commission to East Africa was 295-178, meaning it passed. But many of the yes votes did so only in deference to Herzl. Opponents walked out, but they returned when Herzl took the podium, and the Zionist movement was facing a major schism. In the last words he uttered ever at a Zionist conference, Herzl said they would not abandon the Basel program, not abandon Israel, and he raised his right hand and he said in Hebrew, "Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach yemini." Unity was restored, but Herzl, already suffering from heart disease, was worn down. That Congress formed two commissions, one to work on East Africa and one to work on Israel, but not much came of the former. One Russian Jew who opposed the Uganda plan was Chaim Weizmann, who said that he knows the British can do better than Africa. In his last months, Herzl visited the new King of Italy and then the new Pope of Rome, who reiterated what his predecessor Pope had said: "We cannot prevent the Jews from going to Jerusalem, but we would never sanction it." Obviously, the practical Zionists who favored settlement and were now led by Menachem Ussishkin were horrified by the Uganda plan and openly rebelled against Herzl. They accused Herzl of violating the Basel program. They demanded that Herzl meet with them and pledge never again to entertain any suggested colony outside the land of Israel. Herzl refused to meet them as a committee, but he did meet with them individually. They again argued the relative merits of political versus practical Zionism, but they parted on good terms. Theodor Herzl died on July 3, 1904, aged 44 years. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were shocked, he was very young, mourning his loss. He had, like no one else before, put the Zionist cause on the map. Many considered him a messianic figure. We mentioned, I think, two lectures ago that Rav Kook, newly arrived in Israel, he had just made Aliyah 5 weeks earlier to Yafo, he eulogized Herzl at the shul in Yafo in a speech that was grossly and probably intentionally misconstrued. Rav Kook spoke about Mashiach ben Yosef, the Messiah who rebuilds the material infrastructure of the land of Israel and paves the way for Mashiach ben David. So the point is true, but Rav Kook's critics claimed he was conferring the title of Mashiach ben Yosef on Herzl, which of course he did not, and you could read the eulogy. Herzl was buried in Vienna, leaving instructions that he should be reinterred in the Jewish state when it is established. And in 1949, he was buried on Har Herzl in the area now designated as the burial place of founders and leaders. Herzl sacrificed enormously for the Jewish people. His family life, always troubled, disintegrated after he died. His wife died 3 short years later and was cremated. One daughter died of a heroin overdose. His only son, Hans, committed suicide. Another daughter died in Theresienstadt, and her son, who was Herzl's only grandchild, he jumped off a bridge in Washington, D.C. to his death in 1946. What a sad story, and what an unlikely hero Herzl was. Ratzvi Rakhain Kook once said that much of the opposition of Zionism was rooted in the inability of rabbis to accept that this is the path to redemption through someone like Herzl, because they had it plotted out differently with different stars and different leading players and a different process. But Hashgacha rules, divine providence governs and uses people's talents and good traits as it sees fit. Herzl really personified the Zionist movement to many people, Jews and non-Jews. The real question was now with his death, what comes next? All his contacts were gone, his charisma was absent, his passion was lost. Now what? And there's no doubt that after his death, the Zionist movement meandered, and understandably so. Who led the movement? Most people wouldn't know. Max Nordau was born and raised in a religious home before assimilating, becoming a physician. He was aroused by the Dreyfus trial to the Zionist cause. Because of his fame as a physician, he was actually better known in Europe than was Herzl, and he ably assisted Herzl and organized all the Zionist conferences, but he didn't want to lead. He was the interim leader for a year or so. And then, a year later, after Herzl's death, the movement selected David Wolfson, who was a Lithuanian-born Jew, born into a religious home, educated in Germany. He became the second president and the successor to Herzl. The fact that few people have heard of him is testament not just to his leadership, he was capable, but not a visionary, but really more to the remarkable personality that was Theodor Herzl. Wolfson served for 6 years, he's buried in Cologne, but didn't accomplish very much. The 1905 conference officially rejected the Uganda option, and the split between the practical and political Zionists became more pronounced, because in fact the political Zionists had really no accomplishments on their side of the ledger. Whereas the practical Zionists, well, in the 1900s, settlements were built, land was still being purchased from the Sultan, although Aliyah had somewhat waned. In 1909, Tel Aviv was founded as the first all-Jewish city in the land of Israel, but there was little progress on the political front, and the political Zionists felt that it was a waste of money to settle on territory that might never eventuate in a state. A catalyst was needed, and that catalyst came with the event that really transformed modern history in many, many ways, and that, of course, is World War I. The major Zionist figure after Herzl was Chaim Weizmann. Even if he didn't become the president of the movement until 1921, he was instrumental in leading the British Zionist movement, and of course we'll discuss his role in the Balfour Declaration. But what a fascinating, unconventional life story. Who would have thought? Well, Weizmann was born in 1874 in the shtetl of Motul into a very large religious family, 15 children in all. He attended cheder, but then as he grew, he showed such proficiency in science that for high school, he went to Pinsk, and there in Pinsk, he became active in the Chovei Tzion. Once he graduated high school, the quotas then in place in Russia forced him to leave Russia and attend university in Germany, where he studied chemistry, biochemistry, and it was in Berlin that he first joined the Zionist group. His activities continued in Geneva, Switzerland, where he went to continue his education. He received his doctorate at a university in Geneva, and there he attended also, for the first time, a Zionist Congress, the Second Zionist Congress. All that is fairly traditional. And of his large family, 10 siblings eventually made Aliyah, but not all. He had a brother named Shmuel who was a communist and a Bundist and fiercely anti-Zionist, as was a sister. The brother was purged by Stalin in 1939, murdered and just disappeared. The sister was sent to Siberia in the doctor's plot of 1952. Please mute. 1952, but freed several years later and allowed to move to Israel. Another sister was the paramour of a German spy during World War II, this Chaim Weizmann sister, and she was arrested for espionage by the British in Cairo, never charged, eventually made her way to Israel and worked for Hadassah. In Geneva, back to Chaim Weizmann, Weizmann became engaged to a woman named Sofia Getsova, another Russian Jew. They lived together for 4 years, but then he admitted to her that he was seeing another woman, Vera, who became his wife. Sofia, for some reason, that shidduch didn't work out. She was also a scientific genius, but she was heartbroken, never married, and eventually she became a professor at Hebrew University in the 1920s, after it opened, after Albert Einstein intervened on her behalf. Weizmann, meanwhile, married Vera in 1906, and they lived in Manchester, where he was a professor at the university. They had two sons. One was a British Air Force pilot who was shot down during World War II, presumed dead. The other became a farmer in Ireland. So Weizmann really has no direct roots in Israel, except everyone knows his nephew, Ezer Weizmann, who became very famous for a variety of deeds he performed for the state of Israel. Throughout these years in Britain, Weizmann made numerous contacts in the academic and political worlds, all of which would come in handy in the years to come. In essence, the Uganda escapade demonstrated that the British had interest in the fate of the land of Israel, not totally altruistic, of course, but this factor worked in favor of the Zionists when World War I broke out and the British and the Ottomans were on opposite sides. It's hard to overestimate the complexities of World War I and its effects, some of them we feel until today. Jews fought against each other on opposite sides. The land of Israel suffered terribly from real famine. Literally, Jews died in the street of starvation. Many Jews living in Israel before the war, Russian subjects, were deported by the Turks. Now that they were enemies of the Russians, a good number of them went to Egypt. Many Jews supported Germany because the Germans were fighting against the Tsar, who was Jewish enemy number one at the time. So the Zionists didn't know who to support, whom to support. On the one hand, the Germans were smashing the Tsar's forces. On the other hand, the Turks were allied with the Germans and they held the key to the land of Israel. So that would militate supporting the British who were fighting the Turks. But the British were also fighting the Germans who were against the Tsar. The ideal would have been, of course, had Britain and Germany been allies against the Russians and the Turks. But you can't history doesn't work out like that. You have to follow us with a scorecard almost. So what was the practical effect? The Zionist organization hedged its bets, maintained two separate offices, two separate headquarters during World War I, one based in Berlin and the other based in London. Adding to the complexities, Polish Jews welcomed the Germans as saviors from the predations of the Tsar. They saw the German soldiers as cultured, and the soldiers reciprocated. The German soldiers would give candy and cookies to Jewish children. So a little over 20 years later, many Polish Jews with wartime memories expected similar treatment from the invading Germans, and they didn't get it. But we shouldn't put too rosy a picture even on that. About 200,000 Jews, Rachmana Litzlan, died during World War I, mostly civilians. East European Jews had to flee from town to town. The great yeshivot were exiled. Refugees gathered by the myriads in Vilna and in Minsk because the war was so intense. So what in fact motivated the British? Herbert Asquith, who was the prime minister when the war began, the Earl of Oxford, was not entirely sympathetic to Jews, but he saw the Ottomans committing suicide by allying itself with Germany, and the world knew the Ottoman Empire was decaying in any event. To forestall 100 million British Muslim subjects from joining the Turks, Asquith promised that the Ottoman Empire would be broken up and freedom granted to its many different peoples, including indigenous Arabs of the region. So Jews rejoiced, even if Asquith didn't necessarily mean them, but it could mean that they would have a place at the carving table of the globe after the war. Zangwill was an early proponent of a Jewish legion fighting on the British side in order to put a little finger on the scale of our support. So that would have the dual effect of helping the war effort against the Turks, as well as entitling the Jews to some recompense after the war, instead of just being mendicants. It would also give the Jews some military experience, which they assumed they would need down the road. The practical outcome of this was the establishment of what was called the Zion Mule Corps, supported by Yosef Trumpeldor, together with Zev Jabotinsky. The young David Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi campaigned for it. Pinchas Rotenberg, later the first head of the Israel Electric Company, raised funds in the U.S. for it. A Mule Corps doesn't stand much of a chance against tanks, but the Jewish Legion did see action, acquitted itself well in a subordinate role in the Battle of Gallipoli, but they later fought in the Land of Israel as well. You can tell by the names of the individuals involved that even if it didn't turn the tide of war in any meaningful sense, the Jewish Legion had an important effect on the Jewish psyche. And the existence of Jewish fighters motivated Zangwill to advocate forcefully for Jewish national rights in the Land of Israel as a consequence of the war, and he began this already in 1914. Meanwhile, and here's where the Hashgacha comes in as best as we can understand it, Asquith remained the prime minister until December 1916. If Asquith had not left office, the Balfour Declaration would not have taken place 11 months later, because Asquith was not sympathetic. He left office, his government fell for the oddest reason. That over a few months, the catalyst was a dispute in Parliament over the disposition of German assets in Nigeria. It's hard to understand why that would cause a fall of the government, but over the course of a half year, until December, he rapidly lost support. He was replaced by David Lloyd George, who was a Christian Zionist, who was very warm to the idea of a Jewish homeland, and by Arthur Balfour, who had previously been prime minister about a decade earlier, who now became the foreign secretary, and Balfour knew Weizmann for over a decade. Indeed, It's a famous story. Balfour had remonstrated with Weizmann a decade before over the Zionist rejection of the Uganda plan. Balfour felt it was a big mistake. Weizmann had opposed the plan as well. And Weizmann said to Balfour, supposing I would offer you Paris instead of London, would you take it? And Balfour replied, but Dr. Weizmann, we have London. To which Weizmann responded, that is true, but we had Jerusalem when London was a marsh. Not only that, Lord Kitchener was the British War Secretary, drowned when his ship was sunk in 1916. Kitchener, Ontario, his name was renamed in his honor. The previous name was Berlin. Good reason they changed it. That made Lloyd George the acting munitions secretary as well, and in that capacity, he became familiar with Weizmann, who was then developing explosives as part of his scientific research. Indeed, Weizmann, who registered more than 100 patents in his career, developed a method of manufacturing acetone synthetically. Acetone being the primary ingredient in the making of cordite needed for explosives. This revolutionized the war effort, the British war effort. Weizmann was celebrated, and he used his access to the highest levels of government to promote the Zionist cause. And that he did, seeking an official British statement recognizing the Jewish claim to the land of Israel. His efforts bore fruit, but not without controversy. Weizmann had an ally in Herbert Samuels, a liberal member of parliament, later to become the first British High Commissioner, and a Jew from a religious home who became an atheist at Oxford. But Herbert Samuel had a cousin named Edwin Montagu, who was a leading anti-Zionist, and who had a seat in the cabinet and was even more influential. Montagu was the son of the famous banker Samuel Montagu, a pious Jew his entire life, unlike, unfortunately, his son Edwin, whose wife converted to Judaism only so that Edwin should avoid being disinherited because of an intermarriage. Montagu had the traditional objections to Zionism, stating that Judaism was a religion, not a nationality, and that it would make British Jews second-class citizens whose loyalty is always suspect. Contrast that attitude with the one of the American who first popularized Zionism in the United States. I'm talking about the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis. Brandeis said in 1915, let no American imagine that Zionism is inconsistent with patriotism. Multiple loyalties are objectionable only if they are inconsistent. Indeed, loyalty to America demands rather that each American Jew become a Zionist. He didn't elaborate, that's food for thought. That was Brandeis in America. But Montagu in London thwarted the government again and again from making a strong declaration in support of Jewish rights. In London, Rav Kook, who had arrived in England in 1916, after 2 years in Switzerland, the outbreak of the war had found him at an Aguda conference in, I think it was in Germany. He couldn't return to Israel because he was a Russian citizen, and again, the Turks were at war with the Russians. So Rav Kook then served as the Rav of the Machzike Hadat Synagogue in London. He worked behind the scenes to pressure the government into a statement. But clearly it was Weizmann's achievement, but an achievement that left him dismayed. The British government was officially dealing with Lord Walter Rothschild, who was a passive Zionist, and Weizmann sought three elements in any statement: that the land of Israel should be reconstituted as the national home of the Jews, that there be unrestricted rights of Jewish immigration, and that Jews have internal autonomy. That was the draft submission. It was years in the making, and Weizmann, to his dying day, blamed Montagu for obstructing it. Instead, on November 2nd, 1917, Foreign Secretary Balfour sent a letter to Lord Rothschild in his capacity as head of the British Jewish Federation, a declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations. That was the introduction. With the operative clause, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That, in fact, was a sop to Montague. But note what wasn't there. Nothing that Weizmann had asked for. He asked for the establishment that the Jewish rights be recognized, the national home in Palestine. The declaration may reference to Palestine, but not all of Palestine. It may reference to a national home for the Jewish people, which is not the same as saying that the land of Israel is the national home of the Jewish people. There was no mention of immigration. There was no mention of Jewish autonomy. And certainly Weizmann had not proposed anything regarding the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities. The British rejoiced as their dream of reshaping the Middle East together with the French and preserving their empire seemed secure. Jews rejoiced as this was the first recognition by any nation in 19 centuries of Jewish rights in the land of Israel. Interestingly, Weizmann did not rejoice, saying this is not what he expected. And yet, it was historic. Technically, the Americans did not endorse the Balfour Declaration for many months. Woodrow Wilson hesitated. Brandeis was pushing. And it only achieved international status when the Paris Peace Conference accepted it. And then a few years later, it was embraced by the League of Nations. But importantly as well, it quieted the objections of some of the religious anti-Zionists who relied on the three Shavuot and its ban, Shelo Ya'alu B'Choma, that we are not allowed to capture the land of Israel by force against the will of the nations. As the Remer Simcha of Dvinsk, the Meshech Chachma, wrote, well, you see, now this represents the will of the nations, so we're not taking Israel by force. The anti-Zionists who relied on the notion that there could be no Jewish sovereignty before Mashiach comes, so they were not impressed, but that was always a very small, although vocal, element. Most Jews rejoiced, and November 2nd became a red letter date in Jewish history. Despite the revisionism, the Arab reaction to the Balfour Declaration was muted. I'm talking about the later revisionism. There were any rumblings of opposition to any official Jewish national home, but the Arabs had a very weak hand. They were as much supplicants at the international table as the Jews were. The Middle East had been an Ottoman fiefdom. There was no Iraq, or Lebanon, or Syria, or Jordan, or Saudi Arabia, or sovereign Egypt, etc. The world community was acknowledging that there were competing claims, especially among different Arab tribes and families, to different territories. The Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1915, which was prospective, represented the British and French attempt to, or suggestion to, carve up the Middle East into different spheres of influence. And the Paris Peace Conference sought to concretize that approach. And that brings us to June 1919. The world powers met to resolve all the remaining issues from World War I. A number of Jewish organizations of different stripes participated. Many were Zionist-leaning. Some were not. The American Jewish Congress was very neutral when it came to Zionism. But the host Jewish organization, the French Alliance Israelite, they demanded civil rights for Jews in all countries, and they downplayed Jewish nationalist aspirations. It wouldn't be the first or the last time that Jews undermined our clout by seeking different and even competing objectives. And these were not the innocuous times post-World War I. An estimated 100,000 Jews were murdered in the Ukrainian pogroms that began right after the war ended, November 1918, and lasted until 1921. And these were savage, brutal attacks. For example, the pogrom in Lvov in November 1918, just 1 week after the war ended, killed more Jews than the pogrom did in Kishinev in 1903, but is far less known. And of course, all the travails of the Russian Civil War, we paid a heavy price for that also. President Wilson attended. It was the first time an American president had taken a transatlantic journey. The Allied powers had different conceptions of what they sought. Wilson and his 14 points, make the world safe for democracy, establish a League of Nations, etc. The French and the British and the others, their main goal was to punish and weaken Germany, divide the spoils of war, and ensure the best they could the survivability of their empires. And all this culminated in the Treaty of Versailles, Versailles being right outside of Paris. The British and French succeeded all too well as the land grab from Germany and the harsh reparations that Germany had to pay paved the way for the next and even deadlier war. But in the meantime, the conflict zones were divvied up. Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and elsewhere became independent states. Yugoslavia was a conglomerate of a number of countries, and other states were created on the ruins of the demised Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Middle East took the form that it has retained more or less for a century. Jews who had been part of Hungary or Lithuania, for example, now found themselves divided up into seven or eight different countries, and now countries that were fiercely nationalistic and unfriendly to their Jews. The French were given a mandate, or took it, to govern Lebanon and Syria. The British were given Iraq and the land of Israel on both sides of the Jordan. So the Balfour Declaration was accepted in terms of objectives, but the objectives were so vague that almost immediately there were disputes about what it obligated the British to do. At the time, Lord Curzon, who was the new Foreign Secretary, and the Foreign Office supported a broad interpretation of the declaration and assumed that it meant to create a Jewish homeland. Churchill felt similarly, but the Brits on the ground here in Israel were less supportive. A Jewish homeland was a very low priority for General Allenby, who had entered Yerushalayim December 11th, 1917, and his successors, and truth be told, many of them were comfortable with the genteel Jew hatred of the British elite, obstructed the Zionist vision, were unsympathetic to the Jews, openly supported the Arabs, and saw their mission as thwarting Jewish settlement and statehood. Zangwill was disappointed in the results of the Paris conference, and he thought Weizmann had failed out of timidity because they never asked for a state. The Balfour Declaration was vague, but Zangwill and many other interpreted it as a guarantee of a Jewish homeland. But because Weizmann had not asked for a state, fearing it would be rejected and leave the Jews with nothing, so what was he really asking for then? He was asking for something ambiguous, and Weizmann thought himself to be very shrewd for not demanding a state. And he also maintained that Jews were not ready to govern themselves. This might be true, maybe not. We govern ourselves quite well today in the land of Israel. Actually, we don't. But that irritated Zangwill, who wrote that 1 million Lithuanians were awarded national rights, but not 16 million Jews. What sense did that make? Perhaps Israel Zangwill, who died in 1926, is not better known or appreciated. As best I could find, he has just one street named after him, Rehov Zangwill in Netanya, is because he continued advocating for the grant of some territory somewhere just to save persecuted Jews. But the Zionist movement had moved on from that, even if Ben-Sion Netanyahu notes that by the time of the Peel Commission in 1937, The Zionists were waiving their rights to parts of the land of Israel in order to boost the immigration numbers. So if that couldn't be done, why couldn't they accept some other territory without renouncing any part of the land of Israel? A territory that could have become an Israeli colony once the state was established. Zangwill was also rebuffed because the Zionists rejected statehood so that a Jewish minority would not rule an Arab majority. And those were the numbers at the time, and for quite some time. But in the end, a smaller British minority ruled over an Arab and a Jewish majority. So what was gained by it? In the 1920s, Zangwill also became a proponent of transfer, which grates on modern ears, was very common then. For example, right then, 1 million Greeks had been transferred from Turkey to Greece in order to quell the fighting there. And Zangwill articulated his belief that a stable nation was a simple nation. In one country, one race, one religion, one language. Echoes of this can be found, by the way, in the melting pot. That's how he saw it. You are almost foregoing individual identities to pursue the one group identity of an American. That's a melting pot. All the ingredients blend together. And Zangwill wrote that an ethnic minority will always see the majority as its enemy, the root, he said, of all conflicts, modern and ancient. So we don't like the sound of that, even which doesn't mean it isn't true. It might not have to be so, which is not the same as saying that it isn't so. Interestingly, the Peel Commission, which we'll get back to, would recommend the same. Transferring hundreds of thousands of Arabs just in order to stabilize the land after its partition. But of course, today such discussions are prohibited. In the wake of World War I, the Third Aliyah began. Roughly 35,000 Jews, mainly socialists, came, arrived in Israel by 1921. They established kibbutzim, moshavim throughout the land. Chaim Weizmann was elected the head of the Zionist organization in 1920-21. The Histadrut was founded in 1920, and it founded Bank HaPoalim, literally the workers' bank, in 1921 as well. Well, the British, owing to their own aspirations and the constant changes in their government and the occasional overt hostility by some of their officials to Jews, they did very little to implement the Balfour Declaration and much to impede it. They feared the Arabs as a destabilizing force, and so they catered to them, especially when Arab riots and attacks on Jews erupted in 1920, 1921, and thereafter. They did very little to suppress the disturbances or protect the Jews or to bring the savages to justice, and that would be the pattern. One British general handed Weizmann some papers and said, you know, you should read this. It was the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And this general added, all the British officers in Palestine seem to have it. That was their mentality. When Herbert Samuel was appointed High Commissioner in 1921, the first Jew who governed the land of Israel since the Churban, to placate the Arabs, he appointed Hajj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Yerushalayim. And that rabid Jew-hater would spew his hatred for Jews and instigate violence for the next 50 years. Now think about it. After the riots in 1920, Husseini had been convicted in absentia. He fled the country because he was convicted of fomenting the riots. It was Samuel who brought him back and pardoned him, and elevated him into a position of both authority and prestige. In retrospect, it was awful that he was Jewish, as so often happens, as he bent over backwards to show that he was not biased in favor of the Jews. Beware the leader who just appoints Jews around him without taking any sense or recognition of what kind of Jews they are and how sympathetic those Jews are to Jewish causes. Worse, The British endeavored to mollify the Arabs even more by, in 1921, partitioning the area given to them as their Palestine mandate, deeming 80% of the territory east of the Jordan River as Transjordan, and installing as its monarch King Abdullah I, schlepping him up from Arabia. He was the son of the Sharif of Mecca, and he's the great-grandfather of the current king of Jordan, also Abdullah. He was not native to the land, but Arabia had been given away to the Ibn Saud family. So now there was only about 20% of the original mandate, the land west of the Jordan, that remained for the, or a, Jewish national home. Winston Churchill, who had orchestrated the partition as colonial secretary, saw it as so, and he said, "The Jewish community should know that it is in Palestine as of right, and not on sufferance. That is the reason why it is necessary that the existence of a Jewish national home in Palestine should be internationally guaranteed and rest upon ancient historic connection." But here, too, the ambiguities of the Balfour Declaration became obvious. There was no mention of borders for any Jewish national home. Churchill felt that Jews would have their national home in Israel when they became the majority. So immigration was key. But then the British began limiting Jewish immigration, but not Arab immigration, because the Arabs complained. So how could the Jews ever become a majority? From one perspective, the partition made sense. Before the Mufti's violence, the Zionists rejoiced in the agreement signed by Chaim Weizmann and the Emir Faisal, who was a brother of this King Abdullah, another son of the Sheriff of Mecca, and he represented one group of Arabs at the Paris Peace Conference, later to become the King of Iraq and Syria. So their agreement established the framework for cooperation between a Jewish and Arab state. I quote from the preamble, "Mindful of the racial kinship and ancient bonds existing between the Arabs and the Jewish people, and realizing that the surest means of working out the consummation of their natural aspirations is through the closest possible collaboration in the development of the Arab state and Palestine, and being desirous further of confirming the good understanding which exists between them." And their agreement encouraged Jewish immigration, but it was all conditioned on Allied agreement to the contours of his Arab state. Faisal wrote in a private letter to Felix Frankfurter, "We will wish the Jews a most hearty welcome home." Well, as T.E. Lawrence wrote, I mentioned last time, he's a closet Zionist, if the land east of the Jordan became an Arab state, and the land west of the Jordan became the area of the Jewish national home, Britain's pledges would be fulfilled. Well, the promises made to Faisal were never completely fulfilled. It was unclear who authorized him to speak for the Arabs, and this plan and this agreement was overtaken by the violence and more extreme forces. Years later, when the Peel Commission would recommend partitioning the land west of the Jordan, Churchill termed this a plain breach of a solemn obligation to the Jews, because the understanding was the land west of the Jordan River would be the Jewish state. No matter, Weizmann had placed his trust in the British, and that would characterize his approach until statehood, really until the end of his leadership of the Zionist movement. Thus would begin 25 years of stagnation and much suffering for Jews, with many missteps. In an address of Rav Soloveitchik from June 1948, 1 month after statehood, which the RCA just released a week or so ago, Rav Soloveitchik was very critical of the Zionist trust in Britain and the League of Nations, calling it a form of idolatry, reveling in dependence on human beings and in legalisms that only ended, I quote the Rav now, when they were consumed in the smoke of Treblinka and Dachau, end quote. This is June 1948. No doubt, the British role in the Zionist endeavor was complex and contradictory. They went from being facilitators to being active, even angry opponents, thwarters of the destiny of Israel and fully subservient to the Arab agenda. The Zionist organization would now have to contend not only with the British and the Arabs, but with internal dissent as well, in the form of the revisionism of Zev Jabotinsky. And that will be our next lecture. I thank you all very much.